Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
The wider impact of the American midterms in the sense of the impact on global power politics is the subject of this discussion. Let me start off by saying that the reason why people vote in elections is not generally in order to please commentators, either domestic or even more foreign, and nor is it necessarily to meet the criteria, analyses, shibboleths, or senses of obvious alignment offered by such commentators, particularly foreign commentators. The British public knows that from the way in which Brexit referendum, on which opinion was, you know, fairly evenly divided, was nevertheless analysed as if it was a clear exposition of Britain being this or that or the other, whatever it pleased the commentator of the day to feel. And the same, as it were, caveat needs to be offered when we are considering the American midterms. The reasons why people voted in an enormous electorate and in a multiplicity of contests were not to, as it were, necessarily put a marker down as far as global power politics are concerned. Indeed, I think one can go further than that, that global power politics were not the prime issue in these elections. The elections, after all, were primarily for senators, governors, and members of the House of Representatives, and with reference to local, as it were, referenda on particular issues. And none of those were ones that were framed in terms of international relations. So one can look at bitterly contested races such as those in Ohio, in Pennsylvania, in Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, the last, of course, is going to have a rerun. And you will notice that foreign policy and the world outside are not the prime issues. Nevertheless, I think it's fair to say that first, the elections were to a degree interpreted in that way by many foreign commentators. And secondly, that there were some issues raised during the campaigns that did have a resonance to these wider issues. And the particular issue raised was the one as to whether under President Biden, America was becoming overly committed in Ukraine or was bearing a disproportionate share of the commitment. The two are not identical. You can elide one to the other, but you should only do so with great caution. Not that that stops any commentator. The, as it were, international dimension very much focused on two issues. One, a specific one with reference to two topics in particular, and the second, a more general one with reference to American leadership and indeed, to a degree, the American political system. And I'm going to try and discuss those in turn, but again, as listeners, this is a very intelligent listening group, will know these are not segregated issues. They overlap greatly. So as far as the very first category is concerned, the two particular issues of most note were the one we've already referred to, which was Ukraine, and secondly, the possibility of more acute confrontation between the United States and China. An issue that was pushed to the fore by events and Chinese saber rattling during the electoral campaign itself, although that saber rattling was primarily aimed at Taiwanese public opinion and not that of the United States. Now, clearly, these two are related in that, as some strategists have pointed out and some commentators, Niall Ferguson, for example, has pointed out, America's ability to take a stance on the Taiwan issue may be compromised if it becomes committed over the Ukraine issue. Compromised in a double sense. One, the actual use of resources, but two, more subtly, because it makes it much less easy to try and work at tensions or possibilities of tensions between Russia and China. One can, of course, though, stand this completely on its head and say the exact opposite, which is that possibly standing against aggression and expansionism in the case of Ukraine may well serve to deter China in the case of Taiwan. So, you know, you can take the sort of a variety of points on this one. So those specific things came to the fore, and I think it's fair to say they were linked to the second issue, this issue of leadership. And here the particular point was that the elections, fairly or unfairly, and clearly the answer was only fairly in part, were taken as a kind of plebiscite, to use an old-fashioned word, or let's use the word referendum, on the views of the electorate concerning the previous president, President Donald Trump, more particularly because he had taken a very strong stance in supporting particular candidates, not only against the Democrats, but also in terms of their selection against what he presented as the Republican establishment. And we can use that term because A, it's true in part, but also because it operates as a shorthand which listeners can readily understand. As we all know, an establishment is not a monolith, other than if it's looked at from outside or by critics. Now, from the point of view of it being a plebiscite on President Trump, the assumption beforehand was that if the Republicans did well, this would enable President Trump to launch his anticipated bid for the presidency in the next presidential election, which he indeed has launched, but would have enabled him to launch it with a much stronger traction. And the assumption was that this would have obvious consequences for America's international position. Now, these were seen, and you know, American listeners of President Trump may not be particularly pleased to hear this. It's not my concern at any stage to say things just in order to please people. I do not have any fixed views on many topics. I like to judge them on their merits. And I think the more specific point here is that President Trump is widely seen outside America, and obviously is also seen by many Americans, but is widely seen outside America as volatile, unreliable, and somebody who takes unilateralism to the point of undermining international agreements, international processes, and America's traditional alliance partners. Now, President Trump will no doubt present himself, does present himself differently, but that's not my concern. My concern is here how he is perceived. I ought to add that I think that perception is an accurate one. I think he is somebody who takes his narcissism, and most politicians, in fact, many people are to a great extent narcissistic, but he takes his narcissism in the field of international relations to an extent that compromises America's alliances, just as incidentally, it compromises American domestic politics, and in particular, his role as commander-in-chief. His strictures against military leadership is not one that should be welcomed by Americans, and it certainly isn't welcomed by America's allies. So let's row back. The assumption of a strong traction for Trump appeared to be almost what Vladimir Putin would be waiting for, because The idea that Trump would be powerful would be one that would discourage America's allies within NATO, make them worried, make them anxious that they would be dropped in it by a President Trump or by a President Biden desperately maneuvering to weaken the kind of know-nothing proto-isolationism that Trump stands for, and that this would therefore have compromised the Western position over Ukraine. Let me also make the point, it would have compromised a position taken by prominent Republicans over the last quarter century. It was obviously President George W. Bush who was keen to have Ukraine and Georgia admitted into NATO, a policy supported by the British government of the time, and opposed, thwarted and blocked by France and Germany. And one can wonder whether the situation at the present moment, whether such membership in NATO would have deterred Russian attack and have precluded this crisis. Well, I think it's fair to say that in his stance, in his assumptions, Trump, in a way, is rowing back against the general trend of Republican politics since the 1940s. The Republicans, of course, people like Vandenberg, have played a prominent role in the establishment of NATO. They had supported the permanent allocation of American troops in Western Europe and indeed also in South Korea. And all of those had been important to the architecture, the multilateral architecture of the Cold War. And it seems to be reasonable to say that in this, Trump is cleaving more to a nativist tradition in American politics, which, rather than to one that one would understand as the established Republican one. Now, what about over China? Well, over China and Taiwan, I think it is fair to say that Trump's unilateralism threatened the extent to which there has been an active attempt to create a very strong multilateral pattern of alliances, most recently with America very much strengthening its relationship, its military geostrategic relationship with Australia, but also developing the existing one with Japan. And here the question is not so much as to what specific moves Trump might make, but more to the actual sense of an unreliability of American policy and stance under his leadership. And it has to be said that if one thinks about his major individual initiative in East Asia, which is his attempt by personal diplomacy to solve the North Korean issue, it proved a total failure. But it also proved an example of his unilateralism, and it was not one that is particularly encouraging. To put it crudely, a narcissist like Trump is easily played by cleverer people. And I think that that is a problem that one would have to think about if he was America's leader in confronting China. So America's allies are on the whole, they are obviously much too discreet to say this in public, but are on the whole pleased to see that he did not emerge from the midterms with the kind of triumphalism that might well have dismayed every other Republican and deterred every other Republican other than Mavericks for running against him. And that's important. It doesn't in any way predetermine the outcome, and it may well be that the outcome is still Donald Trump being on the Republican ticket. It is not impossible. He has many supporters. He has drive. And I suspect that Russian and Chinese intervention in American politics will be in order to compromise and weaken any Republican alternative to Donald Trump. But there is another element that is worth considering and thinking about, which is this. The narrative that was very much offered in discussing America, particularly over the last 2 years, but more generally over the last 6 years, was of America as a dysfunctional political system, a broken constitution, and then people added whatever they wanted to add in terms of society, economy, culture, etc., 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 which is an interesting way to refer to the world's leading power and the world's leading economy, but it didn't stop people doing it. And of course, it came from a number of sources. It came from people, as it were, and obviously they were, in a sense, ironically, equally deeply flawed, and they would probably hate to be put in the same envelope, but one can put both Donald Trump and the protagonists of Black Lives Matter in the same envelope and say they jointly were decrying an America which in their terms had failed and which needed drastic rectification, though of course the agenda that they offered was not the same, although there was a similarity in that it was singularly poorly conceived and considered. Now, one would be naive on the basis of a set of electoral results that could easily have gone in another direction to say, ah, well, this is all wrong. But it certainly should give us pause for thought, not least because the American idea of a landslide is always one that is not just a plurality of the vote, and very rarely is this plurality in terms of the popular vote enormous. And indeed, in many cases, congressional majorities, both in the House and in the Senate, have been quite modest. So small marginal shifts actually can be of great substance. Now, what did we see that was encouraging about this midterms? Well, the discouraging thing is yet again, President Trump decried the results and alleged fraud. He alleged fraud, for example, in the voting machines in Phoenix. He had no evidence, of course, for this, but it obviously served his purposes. It also underlines what I've already said on previous programs, that the key element of somebody who believes in democracy is that a person who believes in democracy understands the legitimacy of their opponents gaining power through peaceful and legal means. And unfortunately, by that criteria, I have to say the last president does not fulfill my understanding of what a Democrat means. I shouldn't imagine he's bothered about that for a second. But I suspect that in the eyes of later historians, future historians, he will probably be regarded in a very grim light indeed. Now, what was encouraging about this particular election is that whereas over the last 2 years, a whole cadre of people who quite frankly should have known better and were parroting President Trump's arguments about electoral fraud have not chosen to do so either at all or with the same volume or alacrity after the midterms. Indeed, those defeated have on the whole accepted defeat with an enormous degree of grace, you know, graciousness, and in terms of the traditional values of American partisan politics. So that is good. Secondly, the results have delivered majorities. They've delivered a majority in the House for the Republicans and in the Senate for the Democrats. Now, you might argue that this is a sign of a broken system, but I don't think that's true. It actually conforms to an established practice in America, and not simply in America. One can think, for example, of the extent to which there has been what is called cohabitation in the French model, when one's thinking of the president of one party and a chamber of deputies of another party. And this is not in any way unique. I mean, there are some political systems, Britain obviously, because it doesn't have a directly elected head of state, doesn't have an elected head of state at all, I should say, where such an outcome would seem bizarre. But the American system is not that of a consolidated government. And we can discuss whether that is a form of weakness, but it is the American Constitution. America is a federal society with a separation of powers. And although it might appear to be the case that systems that are dictatorial, for example, such as China or Russia, whether they are or are not ostensibly democratic, although such systems may appear to be more, whatever you mean by efficient, and the Chinese would very much argue that as a basis for their for why their system should be globally accepted, I think most people would accept that not just from the moral, psychological and ideological point of view, that there is a preference for a democracy and a virtue and value in limited government and the separation of powers, but I think a lot of people would also argue that such a system can give everybody, or at least the vast majority of people who are politically active, a sense that they have an ability to participate or to be represented in the political system. I think one can argue that very much in the case of the United States, because there are Democrats and Republicans at all stages of the political system, and therefore it is very difficult to come across with the argument about being totally excluded from governance, from representation in the American system. Indeed, as a federation, which is what America essentially is, a federation in terms of the federalism of the Constitution, but also in terms of different regions, with often significant variations between them, coexisting within a system of governance which does not require a military control of the localities. Given that that's the case, the separation of powers and limited government is a particularly effective way of doing so. And again, what is striking about the midterms is, whereas in the case of the riot at the Capitol on the 6th of January 2021, which was really a form of insurrection, it was an act of political terror, not as destructive in terms of the loss of life as the appalling attacks by Islamic terrorists in New York, on New York and Washington, but nevertheless of similar intention, in other words, using force in order to shatter the political understanding, process, sense of identity, sense of cohesion of a society. There was nothing equivalent in the case of this recent midterms, and the contrast is very apparent if you consider the situation with reference to Brazil, which went to the polls, in which there was a lot of talk about whether the military would intervene, whether there would be political violence on the streets, whether the defeat would be conceded. In the end, Brazil showed again an exemplary situation of in response to what happened, but nevertheless, the American case was even more clearly optimistic in terms of a society with a massive circulation of individually owned firearms and a bellicose rhetoric in much of social media, and yet it was a peaceful transfer of power in the House of Representatives and an acceptance of the senatorial results, however unwelcome they might have been to a considerable amount of American voters. So all of that is good, not, and I use terms like good and bad, historians are not supposed to, but I think it's actually rather odd not to have a ideological and moral view of one's own. All of these are rather good, and I would say that, and are of considerable note to foreign commentators, those who are critical of America. And I have to say that the bulk of academic opinion is on the left in Europe, and is often only too eager to note flaws and criticisms of the United States, but not to have the same kind of scrutiny for societies that are actually one-party states or where the rule of law plays virtually no role. But I think what one could say is that it has been encouraging for those who want to see a strong West and a sense of Western values. Now, this leads me to close on a point, and then obviously, Graham, will, you know, you might tell me I'm totally wrong, which I'm quite happy with. This leads me to close on a point, which is the difference here, I suspect, between British Conservatives and American Conservatives. British Conservatives, understandably, they're foreign to America. They obviously would like to see conservatism do well in America, but A, they do not necessarily identify with all or even many aspects of American conservatism, but two, no more than the Americans do with aspects of British conservatism, but two, and more profoundly, they understandably are most concerned with international relations. And from that point of view, a strong America concerned to defend ideas of freedom and liberty is seen as necessary. And it is seen as necessary both in opposition to dictatorial and expansionist powers, but it is also seen as necessary in order to enable, as it were, the practice of a conservative foreign policy and defence structure within Europe, or the equivalent in, say, Japan or Australia, where they are threatened not just by the explicit threat of these expansionist powers, but also by the implicit threat of anti-liberal left-wing circles who would really like a system of neutralism that in practice serves these expansionist powers. So from that perspective, a set of electoral results that may fill some American conservatives with dismay is not necessarily seen in the same way by those who might rank themselves similarly politically abroad. Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. I certainly want to start with the theme of international relations and America's place in the world. Is it your, where would you, I mean, you referred to Donald Trump's, the tradition of nativism and the way in which Donald Trump fed into that. But do you see continuities in Trump's international outlook and the longer tradition of Republican Party politics? And of course, that rather depends where you take your standpoint from. But I mean, if we look at the attitude of the Republican Party since the Second World War up to and including the two Bushes as president, I mean, there are some things, that there are continuities and things in common. Is it your feeling that Trump really severed that and created something totally different from that tradition, or is it a hodgepodge of the familiar and the unfamiliar?
Well, I think it's a hodgepodge in terms of the policies, but I think in terms of the attitudes, it was a really pretty radical break. I mean, I think it was unilateral to an extraordinary extent. I mean, if you go back to the 1920s, which was a period where you have three Republican presidents in succession. So I was talking about the following period of Republicanism, the post-World War II one. But if you go back to the 1920s, you know, classically people would talk about the Republicans being isolationism there, and they might comment on the restrictions on immigration. But it's also worth bringing out the extent to which America played a quite significant role in the diplomacy in Europe, trying to consolidate the post-Versailles settlement, you know, the western frontier of of Germany, for example, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, or, for example, the Washington Naval Agreement, trying to fix an international agreement on naval strength. And the Americans then went on to participate in the London Naval Treaty of 1930. All of those under Republican administrations. So I would argue that the unilateralism, the sheer unpredictability, the explicit engagement with selfishness that President Trump seemed to have as a sort of scratch, an itch he had to scratch. I think that those do not conform to traditional Republican approaches. I think they more conform to, as I said, to nativist ideas from the 19th century. And indeed, there were always those tendencies on the right, and sometimes on the left, the populist left, but on the right in 20th century United States. I mean, some of the more extreme Republicans, the Birchers, for example, had ideas which are not a million miles away from those of Donald Trump.
It's impossible, surely, to understand the rise of Trump without putting it in the context of international policy at the time, a time in which state building in Iraq had failed and state building in Afghanistan was failing, and to see Trump's success as manifest in the weariness of many Americans to continue intervening in parts of the world where they...
Oh yes, can I just say, I'm not saying that it was necessarily wrong to end interventionism. As you may know, I've always been concerned with strategy to distinguish between what I call first order strategy and second order strategy. First order strategy, very clearly for the United States, is confrontation and containment for China, with after that Russia. I have always argued that America overcommitted to a military action in the Islamic world and that this was militarily foolish. So I'm not talking about him drawing back from really quite rash interventionism. What I'm saying is the manner in which one changes things is really quite foolish. One needs at every stage to try, if you want allies to back you on future occasions, you need to jolly well take them with you, or at least get them to understand where you're at, at the ones of the actions you are taking. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind, most Americans will tell you that they fought in Vietnam on their own. Well, rubbish, of course, leaving aside the South Vietnamese. There were, I think, 48,000 South Koreans. There were obviously Australians and New Zealanders in Korea, of course, in Gulf War I, Gulf War II. The Americans were leading a international coalition. And that suits the configuration of the American military, that it provides the high specification, high tech side of the military. If you want to jeopardize that fully, that's fine. You could take that attitude. I'm not sure I would regard it as particularly wise, but as you will know, there is the hemispheric attitude, which the United States, some isolationists, had in the 30s, in the run-up to World War II, that the United States could defend the oceans by the equivalent of a large fleet, the Two Oceans Act, plus a sort of flying fortresses, aircraft primarily originally designed to deter attacks on American space, and then the rest of the world could go hang. Well, that as a strategy did not emerge terribly well in 1940. When France fell, Britain appeared to be on the eve of falling, and the Americans suddenly got very worried that they might actually have to fight on their own. And I don't think that you can fairly say that the United States has benefited from unilateralism. I would argue that it's a false rhetoric, and I think it's typical of President Trump, to argue that his policies represent the only way to contain unnecessary interventionism. You may recall, for example, that as far as Iraq was concerned, one of the principal opponents of what he saw as unnecessary interventionism and in favour of eventual drawdown was somebody called President Obama. And I'm not sure he's generally seen as a sort of Trumpite.
No, indeed not. I think one of the things that has changed from the period of Trump's victory in becoming president originally and now is obviously the re-emergence of Russia as a both a significant player and threat, which is something that wasn't really one of the big issues in the presidential debates at the time. To what extent has the re-emergence of an aggressive Russia on the European continent focused particularly Republican Party minds in terms of actually seeing some value in NATO? Or is there a feeling that this is a conflict which will end at some stage in 2023 in whatever way, and you know, normalcy will return, and United States can focus on China or other perceived threats?
Well, I certainly think there is a hope of the last, as indeed there is a hope more generally of that last. And I think there is a lot of sympathy, including, I ought to mention, in Britain, there is a lot of sympathy for a view taken by many American commentators across the political spectrum, including President Trump, that whilst the Americans should take a significant role, so also should the Europeans. And you may recall that President Trump was very angry with the German stance of Angela Merkel. Well, he wasn't alone in this. There were many European commentators. If you ask Poles or Swedes or Finns or Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians, they all think Germany has been too placid in the face of Russia. They generally will use much harsher language than that, but this is a family show. I don't think you should necessarily see it as America against the rest. I think that's a mistake. It's the kind of mistake that can be very tempting for nativist commentators to make and for people to make in the rhetoric of an electoral campaign. But I don't think it's an accurate one. There are enormous problems with the Ukraine crisis, as we now are at, which is, how are we going to have closure? And if closure is assumed to mean Russia leaving the Donbass and Crimea, I don't think that would be regarded by many people as credible in terms of a long-term stability in relations between Russia and Ukraine, Russia and the West, let alone in terms of the short term of achieving it. American commentators are not alone. There are many European commentators who, while very concerned about Russia, are also unconvinced by the argument that Russia can be easily defeated and driven from the lands it has seized. As far as your broader point, the re-emergence of Russia as a threat, I think Russia already had shown its aggression in 2008 in Georgia, 2014 in Crimea. I think there was an extraordinary degree of naivety. That naivety was one in which the Americans shared, but I think it was principally, a matter of, in particular, the Germans and the French believing that they could create a European order in which Russia would be accommodated readily. And as you can see, it didn't work. I'm not saying it was an ignoble goal, it was just foolish. Well, can I just say, as you may know, I have argued very consistently, and you will know this, I published an article in Standpoint years ago, one of the predecessors of The Critic, arguing that the literature produced on the origins of World War I, particularly by Sir Christopher Clarke, who was given his knighthood for services to Anglo-German relations, the Regius Professor at Cambridge, who basically said all powers were equally guilty, Now, I have argued this is rubbish, and the corollary of that would be to argue that everybody is equally guilty for the crises in Eastern Europe. I do not believe that is the case. I think it's a deeply flawed and very foolish argument for 1914, one that completely underplays the role of the military in Austrian and German policymaking. But leaving that aside, it certainly is a travesty of the way in which the crises in Ukraine have played through. And I'm sorry to see that people like the Pope, the current Pope, have argued that the expansion of NATO into Eastern Europe was in some way responsible for this. Well, that is, I'm afraid to say, a deeply troubling argument.
Well, indeed, we will. That's a very moderate way of phrasing it. Thank you very much. I'd love to continue talking, but we're out of time, I'm afraid. Professor Jeremy Black, for looking at the situation in the United States following the midterms and what it could mean for the future of American international relations. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Listeners may be interested in my book, Military Strategy, A Global History, because it is pertinent to many of these issues we're talking about.
Indeed, indeed. Thank you again. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.